December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
History, through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Thousands gathered on the island of Oahu on December 7th, 2016 to mark the 75th anniversary of that date which has lived in infamy. A day that left devastation and destruction, but also stirred in America a resolve and determination that would eventually defeat tyrannical forces and truly change the world. We're going to reflect on that day in this special edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this amazing country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are seemingly ordinary Americans around you who have endured extraordinary circumstances on our behalf. They don't want to call themselves heroes, but we can certainly take stock of what they did and what they went through and decide that our veterans deserve our unending gratitude for their service and sacrifice. We don't want to lose sight of the price that has been paid for our freedom. And as we listen to their memories, we are educated, entertained, and yes, inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Usually we spend the entire hour listening to one veteran's story from start to finish, but this time, since we've been joined over the years by dozens who were there on Oahu on December 7th, 1941, we're going to get a composite, a mosaic of perspectives on how these young people from all over America experienced that fateful Sunday morning. Some of the voices you'll hear are still with us, and we're even there at Pearl Harbor to mark the 75th anniversary. Others have left us and reunited with their friends among the 2,400 Americans who perished in that surprise attack. Hawaii wasn't a state yet in 1941, and most Americans had never heard of Pearl Harbor. But they received details and exhortation from President Franklin Delano Roosevelt in one of the most legendary speeches of all time, heard just like this over the radio in every corner of our country on December 8, 1941.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. Indeed, 1 hour after Japanese air squadrons had commenced bombing in the American island of Oahu, the Japanese ambassador to the United States and his colleague delivered to our Secretary of State a formal reply to a recent American message. And while this reply stated that it seemed useless to continue the existing diplomatic negotiations, it contained no threat or hint of war or of armed attack. It will be recorded that the distance of Hawaii from Japan makes it obvious that the attack was deliberately planned many days or even weeks ago. During the intervening time, the Japanese government has deliberately sought to deceive the United States by false statements and expressions of hope for continued peace. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost. In addition, American ships have been reported torpedoed on the high seas between San Francisco and Honolulu. Yesterday, the Japanese government also launched an attack against Malaya. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Hong Kong. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Guam. Last night, Japanese forces attacked the Philippine Islands. Last night, the Japanese attacked Wake Island. And this morning, the Japanese attacked Midway Island. Japan has therefore undertaken a surprise offensive extending throughout the Pacific area. The facts of yesterday and today speak for themselves. The people of the United States have already formed their opinions and well understand the implications to the very life and safety of our nation. As Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense, but always will our whole nation remember the character of the onslaught against us. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory. Interpret the will of the Congress and of the people when I assert that we will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery shall never again endanger us. Hostilities exist. There is no blinking at the fact that our people, our territory, and our interests are in grave danger. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph, so help us God.
It would take the better part of 4 years at the cost of over 406,000 American lives, but that triumph did prove inevitable, and that rallying cry of the day, "Remember Pearl Harbor," is one that sticks with us today. But what is it that we're remembering, and why? No one can better illustrate that than those who were there that day, and we'll start with a man I met at the USS Arizona Memorial in Hawaii years ago. Al Rodriguez grew up in Hawaii. You may have seen him in some of the television coverage of the 75th anniversary remembrance. And here's what he remembers about that Sunday morning three quarters of a century ago.
Well, that morning I was stationed at the naval facility called Section Base Bishop's Point, which is at the mouth or the entrance to Pearl Harbor. I just happened to have the duty that morning at the 48 watch, and at about 6:30 we got word that one of our destroyers, the USS Ward, was dropping depth charges on an unidentified submarine. And the message came to our base, and the quartermaster on deck says, "Hey, we got a problem here." And he told me what had happened. At 7:45, I got relieved from my duties and went to have breakfast. I had just sat my tray down when we heard a lot of explosions. And then all of a sudden, the general alarm sounded. We all ran out to the armory where they issued us 30 caliber rifles or 45 pistols when they ran out. And that's all we had to shoot at the planes with. But of course, 1941, the planes were slower than they are today, and they were flying low enough where you could see the pilots' faces. I'm sure we hit the planes because there were enough of us shooting at them. The planes were low enough where, as I said, you could see the pilots' faces.
So you were firing a 45 at the Japanese pilots?
I had a 30 caliber rifle. You know, that was a one-shot thing. You you cocked them after every shot, so you didn't fire much. You fired enough, however, because there were enough planes coming down. But like I say, that's all we had to protect us.
How soon did you realize, boy, this is huge, this is enormous, this is catastrophic? Did it sink in right away, or did it take a while?
It sunk pretty fast, because, you know, especially when, you know, I was a storekeeper, and when one of the officers came along, he took my gun away. He said, "You get in that warehouse and open that warehouse for any supplies that people needed." And I was really scared. And some of the bullets, you see, we're right next to Hickam Air Force Base, and they were strafing the planes on the airfield, and a couple of bullets came right through the roof of our, we had a tin roof, and that scared the heck out of me. It lasted for 2 hours, and it seemed like 2 days. You really don't have time to think. You're just acting. It really scared me.
For the nation, Pearl Harbor became such a rallying cry. Remember Pearl Harbor was really what everyone got behind and motivated them to fight the enemy. What about for you, having experienced and seen that devastation firsthand on December 7th? Is that something that kind of stuck in your mind as you went out to fight the Japanese in the Pacific?
It always did. It always will. That's why I enjoy coming here to tell my story to the people who visit us.
Al Rodriguez was doing that 7 years ago when I met him there at Pearl Harbor, and he still goes there to tell his story today at the age of 96. And he mentioned that his Navy outpost was near Hickam Field. That new air base is where Ed Hall was on December 7th, 1941. The South Carolina native was getting breakfast ready in a mess hall and passed off the first explosion he heard as an air compressor firing up. The next one was unmistakable.
And then I heard the darndest explosion you'd ever want to hear in your life. Now I thought something blew up outside. I ran to the back door, looked up Hangar Avenue. Hangar 7 and 9 had blown up and debris was flying everywhere. And I thought, my God, an airplane exploded in one of the hangars? And then about that time, Hangar 2 and 4 was right across the street from me. The entrance was in line with the door where I was standing. Guys were running out of the hangar, scattering all over everywhere. And then I saw puffs of asphalt kicking up. What the hey? And then I saw this plane coming across the runway the wrong way. Holy mackerel, who's this idiot? And then I realized that's gunfire. And this plane is coming right at me. And this guy is so low, he couldn't have been more than 25, 30 feet off the ground. But he had to pull up to miss the building and the electrical wires that were outside. That's what saved my life, because he was coming straight at me. As he flew over, I looked up. He was looking down at me, and I was looking up at him, and he had a big smile on his face. I mean, that's how close he was, that I could see him. So then I went running out, hollering for Alex, "Where is everybody?" Well, they had all disappeared. Oh, I got to tell you one other. As I turned around, before I could yell at Alex, I decided, I got to hide someplace. Oh, the kitchen sink. So I dived under the kitchen sink. And things seemed to quiet down just for a second or so, and that's when I got out, started yelling for Alex. And I ran outside, and now I'm still in awe. I'm staring out in the air, looking at all these planes flying around. And one guy reaches out from under the eave of a building, grabs me by the shoulder, curse me out, "You're going to get killed, get under here." And I didn't more than get under the eave of that building. Here comes another plane strafing, took off about 2 inches of that edge of that building, number two.
Second time your life was saved.
Second time. So now this is the hick with the mess hall. I got to get down to the motor pool because I know they're going to need drivers. So I go down there, and I was told to take a truck and go up Hangar Avenue and do whatever I could to help out. Well, it always, even to this day, it seems a mystery to me how this happened. But as I got up near the hangars, it had exploded, which was right across the street was the big barracks. And the guy come running out, waving his hands, "Stop, stop, I need you, I need you." I said, "Who are you?" He said, "I'm a medic, we got wounded. We got to get them to the hospital." So that's what I did for the rest of the day. And then we took a load over to the hospital, came back over on Hangar Avenue, and went in between the hangars, picking up wounded. I picked up one dead lieutenant, and he had a .45 automatic. I figured, well, his guts are spilled all over it. He don't need it. So I took his .45. I never cleaned that belt either. It still had blood on it the day I had to turn it in when I came back to the States. But I believe it was the second, or could have been the third trip that we made. We got strafed again. The tires were shot out on the truck, and we had bullets come between him and myself through the cab that just missed both of us. Actually, we didn't realize that until we stopped and picked up another wounded. Well, we stopped when the tires went flat. Not to pick up a wounded, really, but there was wounded there. And as he got out and went to shut the door, he says, "My God, Ed, look at the holes in the roof." I looked at him, "My Lord, where the..." And then I realized the tires had been shot out, and these dang gun bullets came through the roof of the cab, number three. Well, that was my three close calls for the day. So the rest of the next 2 or 3 hours, we were still roaming around looking for wounded. I couldn't tell you how many people we picked up that were wounded.
Are we talking like dozens?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, at least. And I believe I just knew these fellows. I can't say they were friends, but they were acquaintances. Leonard Beasley, Eugene Denson, and Robert Kelly. Now, Robert Kelly I knew real well. They were killed that day, those three. All three of them belonged to the 42nd Bomb Squadron.
Three of the 189 airmen killed at Hickam Field on December 7th, 1941. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, a man who was flying his bomber into Hickam Field that morning. By the time we're done, we'll have heard from 10 different men who witnessed that day that changed the world. Link to all their full-length original interviews at hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph, so help us God.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. On a week where the world's attention focused on Pearl Harbor, where so many survivors returned for the 75th anniversary, when dedicated Americans gathered at the National World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. in the rain to read off every one of the 2,403 names of those who died on Oahu on December 7th, 1941, we are remembering Pearl Harbor through the memories of men who were there. Robert Thacker would go on to become a legendary pilot, even setting a world record in a P-82 twin Mustang named for his wife, Betty Jo. But when he kissed Betty Jo goodbye in Northern California on December 6th and took off over the ocean for Hawaii, he had no idea what he'd be flying into.
We had been up all night for 2 nights, no sleep. You're young, and you think you can have anything and do anything. So we really weren't concerned. And all of a sudden, here's this big hole in the clouds. I look straight down, Diamond Head. My navigator had flew 2,500 miles and wasn't off 1 mile by shooting 3-star fixes all night long. Hobdy, great guy, great navigator. So I let down through the hole, flying along. My radio operator had been there before, and he said, there's Doris Duke's home. We're blah, 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 blah. And I saw these scratches in the sky, and I said, what are those? And he said, that's volcanic action. And there's the Royal Hawaiian. And I said, blah, 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 on the horn. No answer from the tower. No answer from me. This is 8 o'clock in the morning. And you know when the attack started. When? 8 o'clock. So I said, hell, I can see. I said, where's Hickam? He said, you see that big white tower there? That's Hickam, and that's the Pearl Harbor. So I said, what's that great big column of black smoke that just went up? He said, they're burning off the cane fields. Well, that was the Arizona going up. And I said, blah, 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 noise. Come up here and give me a new frequency. I can't get anybody. So, I can see the runway. I can see that big black smoke and see which way the wind is blowing. I'll land this thing because we're out of fuel. We're exhausted. We've been up all night, two nights in a row. So I cracked about half flaps and dropped the gear and started over Ford Island. All of a sudden, a tower came on and said, number Air Force 432, you're number 2 to land, land north to south. We're under attack by Japanese aircraft. And exactly like that, bang, 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 all over the place. The Navy was shooting at me. Well, I was right over Ford Island, and everything was on fire, and anything that was airborne that morning, you know, was what? It was the Jap. And I've been criticized by calling the Jap, but in those days you used the word Jap. Now it's Japanese, which is fine with me. But I said, my God, I'm going to get out of here. So I dropped the throttles, broke out of traffic to the right, landed crosswind. There were 3 zeros jumped me. They shot the right gear out. I ground looped on the end of the runway and took a look around. And I said, I think we better just redirect here. All I needed was a tire and bombs and fuel, and I could go. And I started towards the flight line. And I said, no, I think this is a mistake. Let's go between Hickam and the commercial airdrop. In those days, it was nothing but a big swamp. So we went over to the swamps, and that's the best idea I ever had, because right then, these 13 in a nice V-level Japanese bombers came over Hickam, and they just wiped out the flight line, killed a couple of friends of mine on the flight line, and if we'd have been over there, we wouldn't be here talking to you.
So that was Robert Thacker. Up next, Francisco Paredes, one of 16 children in a Mescalero Apache family from Arizona. He was stationed at Schofield Barracks.
I was on my way to church for mass, and all of a sudden I heard a big noise, and the sirens went off, and they says, this is not a drill, this is not a drill. All personnel report to your stations. I didn't have a station. But we did have machine guns set up, you know. So what I did, I manned the first machine gun that I could find, and it was a Twin 50 on a Heinz mount. I spotted this torpedo bomber. He was probably about maybe 150, 200 feet up in the air. I could see the pilot, and I took a burst at him, and I missed him. Then I gave him a lead, and then I took another burst at him, and I smoked him. I don't know whether he went down, but I'm pretty sure he did went down, because he started going towards the ocean. So that's when everything went haywire. So I start picking up, fighting fires, helping out, you know, with whatever I did. And I helped for about maybe 7 or 8 days. I start pulling bodies, limbs, you know, arms, legs, you know, and heads. And it was awful. Thinking about it, you know, it makes me cry. The poor people, innocent people that got caught in a turmoil like that.
Frank Paredes was stationed at Schofield Barracks. So was Herb Weatherwax. But the Hawaii native, known affectionately now as Uncle Herbie, wasn't on the base on the morning of December 7th.
About 10 days before that attack, the Army had been alerted to get out to our defensive position. And that's what we did. We got onto that, and that meant that we had to get prepared for an invasion by sea. And I was in a communication section, and we laid all the telephone lines to get everything all prepared. And we thought that we were all set, but we didn't know what for. We didn't know that something was going to happen at Pearl Harbor or not, but our orders were to get prepared. And so we did that. I was let out on a weekend pass. On that weekend, I was at home. Early that morning, I heard a very loud explosion. And it was a beautiful day. And I looked in the direction of the sound, and that was over Pearl Harbor. And the sky was just black with smoke in that area. And then I turned the radio on. They announced over the radio that all military personnel report to your station immediately. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor. Immediately, I got a ride down to the bus stop in Honolulu. And there we got on the bus. And then as we were heading for Schofield Barracks, we had to pass by Pearl Harbor. And as soon as I entered that area there, I looked out and I was shocked. I had a shock of my life. The Arizona was already on fire, and it was a terrible sight. All the ships in the back of the Arizona was ablaze. And as I say, the sky, that area was just black with smoke. And I saw the Oklahoma had already been torpedoed. She killed over. I could see the hull. And I could see little objects scrambling on the hull of the ship, which was the men that escaped. And our bus kept on going, headed on. And we passed by Wheelerfield, which is just next to Schofield Barracks. And there I saw all our airplanes that had been parked in the runway, all ablaze. The hangars were ablaze. And then I saw the one lone plane circling around Wheelerfield. And that's the only plane I can remember out of the 350 plane that was sent out to attack Pearl Harbor. And we got together at Schofield Barracks, and we had to travel all around the island in order to our position, which was located where the naval air base was, Kaneohe Naval Air Base. And when I approached that Kaneohe Naval Air Base, I was shocked again to see that base on ablaze, and all the airplanes, the seaplanes were all ablaze. And then we were all excited, of course. We were waiting for the Japanese to follow up with an invasion, which is what we expected. So that evening, we were all keyed up, and we were concerned about saboteurs too at the time. But then the next day came about, and there was no invasion. Then later on, about 2 days afterwards, we found out that they had turned around, a Japanese convoy had turned around and headed back to Japan. But the damage that was done was so bad.
Indeed, and one man who saw the damage from a unique view is Uncle Herbie's longtime friend from their shared appearances at the USS Arizona Memorial. Delton Wally Walling was 180 feet above the surface in an observation tower that morning.
Now it's 7:56, and we're standing there, and it's a beautiful day. And all at once, overhead, we've got planes, high planes, low planes, all coming in on us. Oh, must be a big maneuver today. Those orange balls up there is not ringing the bell yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's not ringing the bell even when we see those black objects dropping out of those planes.
It hasn't hit you yet that this is enemy.
That isn't it. Mm-hmm. And when the bomb went off on Fort Allen and all the planes are exploding everywhere, we know we're in war. I'm froze to the rail because the first thing that happened just before the plane started dropping was Hickam Field is blowing up. It's right behind me. I'm looking, oh, maybe a couple minutes or something before the raid started right over Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
So Hickam Field is destroyed immediately. Now I'm froze to that rail because I have joined the greatest Navy of all times. And here it is, being blown up in my face in a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm devastated. Because if they can do that in 10 minutes, what else is coming?
Right.
And scuttlebutt is everywhere. They've already landed on the other side, and, oh, man, you don't know what to believe. The Arizona never blew up till 8:06. It's the last ship that blew up. Because your California is sunk, Oklahoma's rolled over, the Utah's rolled over,
mm-hmm.
and the West Virginia's got hit by at least 7 torpedoes. It's a mess. It went straight down.
And you're seeing each one of these?
I'm seeing it after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot possibly see it because you're looking there, a bomb went off, one's already gone there. You're looking and seeing after the fact. The Shaw being on dry dock,
right.
Up in the air.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when it was hit and the magazine blew it apart, now that concussion, because they're in the air, just comes high. So we did feel the concussion from where we were at on the tower from the Shaw.
Mr. Walling was back at Pearl Harbor this week for the anniversary, and so was Chester Ski Bernacki, who lives not far away from him now in California, but was actually shooting in Wally's general direction, unknowingly, of course, in his duty as a shellman on a 5-inch 38 gun mount aboard the cruiser USS Helena.
I had breakfast, and I decided I'd go ashore. So I went down to Foot Locker, and I broke out my shoes and put another buffing on them, and I was sitting there, and I got an uncomfortable feeling. And I said, I think I'll go topside and have a smoke. So as I started up the ladder, the general quarters alarm sounded, and it says, all hands manage your battle stations. Not knowing what the heck was going on, I dropped everything, which you were trained to do, and I headed for my mount, my battle station. And just as I got inside the mount, there was a big explosion. And I figured, what the hell's going on here, you know? We manned the mount, and they reported to sky aft, went into director control, and we started firing. From what I understand, I think we were the first ship to get hit. It came over Fort Island toward the 1010 dock that we were tied up at, in place of the Pennsylvania, which should have been there, but the Pennsylvania had moved forward into the dry dock.
Right.
Which was ahead of us.
And when you say there was an explosion, I want to make it clear for people listening, you're not talking about an explosion on another ship. You're talking about an explosion on your ship that you felt.
Oh, yeah, the ship just shook, and I didn't know what was happening. You know, who would think you were going to be in the start of a war?
Right.
You know, but like I say, being we had so much training that everything fell into place. You did things automatically without even thinking.
And I want to ask about something else you said there, too. You know, you said that you were going to go ashore, and then you got an uneasy feeling. Premonition that something was wrong, or what?
I don't know what it was. I really don't. Honestly, I'm being honest. I said, I think I'll just go up topside and have a cigarette, you know. And as I did, the announcer system from the quarterdeck are telling us, man your battle stations. So being trained like we were, everybody headed for what they were supposed to do. And what was bad about it is it happened so fast that we didn't have time to set the damage control all over the ship. So when we got hit, we got hit in the forward fire room, between the forward fire room and the forward engine room. Just put a big gaping hole in the side, and she just settled there at the dock, which wasn't very deep, you know.
You get to that battle station, and you're loading these shells, loading shell after shell after shell, I would imagine.
But you can't see anything, right?
No, because we're inside the mount.
So you have no idea what's happening out there.
I had no idea. And then all of a sudden there was a, I forget how long we were firing, but then we had a lull. And we were told to go outside, clear the casings off the deck, throw them over on the dock, and cut the awnings down, because we had awnings, frilled awnings, you know, up over the bow and the quarter deck and stuff. We had to get that canvas off the ship so it wouldn't catch fire and stuff and whatnot. I looked over toward Battleship Row, and all you could see was this smoke and the motor launches and tugs running around picking up survivors and stuff. It was off in the distance,
right?
You know, but you could just see turmoil, black smoke rising. And at the time, if I remember right, when I looked over there, I thought I saw the Oklahoma capsizing.
The Battleship Oklahoma, with 429 sailors lost, a number surpassed only by the 1,177 killed on the USS Arizona. When we come back, we'll hear from two men who were on the Oklahoma, as well as one from the USS Pennsylvania. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo. We will always remember how they died for liberty. Let's remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory.
That was the Sammy K Orchestra during World War II, and we're remembering Pearl Harbor today through the recollections of 10 different men who were there that day. Alabama native Russell Winsett was assigned to the battleship USS Pennsylvania, his duty station, a machine gun nest high up in the air.
Walking down the dock, I heard the sirens go off, battleship, man your station.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I rushed aboard ship and went up to my machine gun nest. Lo and behold, ammunition boxes were locked. And I said, I'm not going to climb that ladder back down and back up to get the keys. So I took what they call a dog wrench. It was a pipe about this long and broke a lock. Lo and behold, some young ensign in the Navy, he wanted to put me on report for destroying government property.
He didn't think Japanese planes coming overhead and bombing you guys was a good enough excuse. Huh?
Right. So, anyway, the captain saw that what the report was, and he just shook his head, told it, and beat it.
So you heard the signal for general quarters.
You get to your machine gun. Had you seen planes in the sky? Did you know what was happening, or was this just chaotic?
Well, I could hear a lot, bobbing and everything, guns shooting, but I had no idea what was going on. Where we sat in dry dock was up above most of them in the water, you know. You could see a lot, but I knew it wasn't no drill. I knew it was for real.
So you man that 50 caliber machine gun, you bust open the ammunition box so you actually have something to shoot at them, and then what are you shooting at? What are you seeing as you look out on that scene?
Well, actually, I couldn't see too much because you had a band around you to hold you up to the gun, and I couldn't see much except when the plane would come in my scope there. I didn't know what was going on. I could hear a lot, and it was pretty scary.
As far as what that looked like, the number of planes that were coming through, or how much time you had to react if you actually saw something, I imagine there's probably nothing that could prepare you for that.
Well, you figure you see two or three come over and are strafing, you knew there's going to be more, so you just sit and wait for them. That's all we can do.
How close did those planes come to where you were?
I'd say some of them 100 feet, come right over the bow of the ship.
You could see markings on those Japanese planes?
Oh, yeah. I could even see the pilot with a Japanese grin.
You could see the face of the pilot?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know that was a long time ago, long, long time ago. What did that feel like to be in that situation? Because now we look back and everybody knows, well, Pearl Harbor happened December 7th, 1941. But I can't imagine the feelings that must have been going through you because it was so unexpected for you.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. Believe it or not, I never got scared until it was all over.
Hmm.
Because it really didn't have time to get scared.
How long do you think you were there in that position continuing to man that machine gun?
Oh, probably a couple of hours.
Did it feel like longer?
Felt like all day.
Yeah, I bet.
A friend of mine, he was from Orlando or somewhere down here in Florida, and he was the ship's photographer. And he had climbed up a leg of the mast. It had ladders on it, and they climbed up there to get pictures. And they shot him right off, killed him. That hurt me bad.
When did you start to grasp the magnitude of what happened there that day? Not just with your ship, but the entirety of...
Well, really, that happened about 8 o'clock in the morning. So after that, you had time to look around, and I'd say a couple of hours, you know, you could see the damage had been done, and you knew there was a lot of lives lost because those ships rolled over and were bombed and everything. A lot of people lost.
Can you paint a picture for us of what it looked like from your vantage point as you scanned the horizon, what you could see?
Well, it'd be kind of hard to describe, but out across the bay, or channel rather, we saw ships laying close to each other, some collapsed, some on fire. It was quite a deal there.
You could see smoke in the air?
Oh, yeah. Smoke and flames, and you could smell bodies burning. That wasn't good.
No, and it was especially dire on the USS Oklahoma, as David Russ Russell knows all too well.
I was in the compartment just reading a book, and Lieutenant Rommel gets on the loudspeaker. He says, this is attack, fellas. And he didn't say this. He said that S word. And boy, that woke us up. And about that time, those torpedoes start hitting us. And pow, 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 pow. 9 of them hit us.
And where were you?
I was in the compartment. And those torpedoes just hit me, well, probably 80 feet from me and just across from me there.
So what did that feel like?
Oh, my goodness. You know, as clean as those ships were, dust. I don't know where the dust came from, but it probably come from the blowers, the air blowers.
Mm-hmm.
You started coughing, so much dust. It's unbelievable.
Well, it sure seems like there's nothing that could prepare you for this. And you're trying to figure out what in the world's going on probably, right?
Yeah, what do I do next? When he said air attack, I had two battle stations. If we came under air attack, I was to sink cover. I had to go down below decks, below the armor decks. And if we go to surface action, my battle station was the 5-inch 51s. They were in casemates alongside the ship.
Uh-huh. So where'd you go?
So every day I went down below decks. And I went down. That hatch I went through is 13.5 inches thick armor plate. From 13.5 inches down to 8 inches, 3/4 inch length of the ship. And they started to close the hatch, and I said, well, you know, my mind started operating, and I said, I've been trained to be a first loader on an anti-aircraft gun. In case somebody gets hurt, I can replace them. And by the time I got out of that ship, it was halfway over. Yeah, it began to capsize, you know, right away.
Yeah. You said the number, 9 torpedoes, and that ship
several
starts...
Several bombs, yeah.
And it's starting to turn over, ends up tipping over something like 150 degrees, right? I mean, almost mm-hmm. completely...
And,
upside down.
And trying to get out of those compartments, you know, people were dogging, you know, they dog everything down, those hatches. There's 8 dogs on every hatch. It's not like these quick
right.
disconnect hatches that we have today. But I would try to undog them. Somebody else on the other side would dog them down. And then I had to climb over lockers. The concussion or the explosions caused those lockers to break loose. So I had to divert myself around to get out or climb over the lockers.
Could you see? Was it dark under there?
We had portholes when I got up on the main deck there, and they were still open.
Right, but you had to get up there first. So you're well, scrambling over fallen lockers. There's probably is there water
well,
rushing in too?
See, we had battle lanterns also.
Right.
When we locked last Tuxedo, the battle lanterns went on.
Mm-hmm. I imagine it's just chaos all around you probably, right? You have other guys that are trying to figure out what they're trying to do or where they're going?
Well, it was pretty well organized. You know, we used to well train. We had no problems. You know, people up starboard and down port.
Have you ever stopped to think about what if I hadn't made that decision to go topside when I did?
Those men are still down there. Yeah, they got trapped, yeah.
And of all the ships at Pearl Harbor, only the Arizona lost more men than the Oklahoma.
429 we lost. Mm-hmm. A lot of my friends. Mm-hmm.
What was going through your mind while this is happening?
Oh, everything goes, why did Japan do this? You know, why? Because those warlords in Japan, they were different.
So when you did get to the surface or to the top of the ship, it's already starting to roll over?
The water just began to come over the main deck there. And the ship was... what, about 80 degrees?
Mm-hmm.
About ready to capsize.
So if you're on the top, you're really on the side with the way the thing is turning.
Yeah, the deck is facing you, yeah.
Uh-huh.
The water hose coming across, I grabbed a water hose and just hand over hand myself up. Oh, then I went down over the side.
Because the ship's turning, you're basically climbing to get to what was the side, which is now the top, and then you slid off into the water?
No, half-inch thick steel plates.
Uh-huh.
They were riveted together, so I just went down, I got a hold of the edge of that, and I just gave one big leap, and I caught a line from the Maryland. We were tied alongside.
Uh-huh.
And I got a hold. See, there was fire coming down between the two ships.
Right.
From the Arizona, and I didn't want to get that water because I'm afraid that, you know, the way the wind was blowing that fire down, I thought, oh my, you know, I could see those guys walking in that fire and swimming in it, trying to push that oil away from them, but they just couldn't do it. But anyway, I called up on the Maryland, and they were at general quarters. They're firing their 1.1 guns, anti-aircraft guns, so I just over there and I wanted a few instructions on how to handle that ammunition, and I got it, and so I helped him pass ammunition.
Russ would have to wait another day to find out that his uncle had been rescued from the capsized hull of the Oklahoma, something the late Richard Swede Artley told us about on this program from his first-hand experience. A story in which the relief of survival is tempered by the sobering reality that Artley's older brother, Darryl, was killed on the Oklahoma that day.
We had just come back from breakfast. We thought we had something that had run into us when the first torpedo hit. But the Navy says they're absolutely positive that 8 torpedoes hit the Oklahoma and very likely 10. I was in the steering room aft. I was just below the waterline. There were 8 of us in there. We had lights for about 10 minutes. Then the lights all went out. Of course, the ship turned over to port 151 degrees. just a little bit of her bottom sticking out of the water.
And we've seen those famous pictures of the Oklahoma on December 7th. I have to ask, I mean, I haven't talked to anybody who was through what you were through on that day, to be trapped like you were. As those torpedoes are hitting, what did that feel like? What did that sound like? And did you have any idea where you were or what was going on?
Well, I knew where we were, but I didn't know that we had gotten into a war. We just tried to keep from getting hit by things flying through the air when the ship was turning over to port. And I didn't do a very good job because we had a guy named Woody Havens, who was a heavyweight wrestler. Mm-hmm. He was a second-class quartermaster. He had all kinds of equipment down there, dumbbells and all that stuff, you know, to train on. And one of his dumbbells, I don't know why, I could never make myself understand what the heck I was doing in the telephone booth. But I had just stepped out, and one of his dumbbells came down and hit me in the leg.
Did it break your leg?
No, it didn't break it, but I had 13 bones in there that sprung loose.
So this is all happening on December 7th, 1941, as a nation is about to realize that it's at war. And you were realizing it before pretty much anyone else. I mean, the very first torpedoes were hitting your ship, would sink your ship, and you're trapped inside your ship as it's turning over. When did you realize that you were trapped, and what was going on inside that room? What kinds of things were being said? Set that scene for us if you can.
I didn't know we couldn't open any of the doors in the steering aft, but they were all locked from the other side. If I'd have known that, I would have gone nuts. And so we just, hell, I slept some of the time down there. And the water was still coming in. There was a fresh air blower coming into our room because it was hot down there. Oh, God, it was hot.
So these air vents are letting water in. You can't get out. So the room is filling more and more with water, less and less with air, and you guys are running out of time.
I think so. I talked to Jim Bounds one time, and I asked him, just a short time before he died, I asked him, I said, Jim, how much time do you think we had left down there before the compartment was completely full of water? He said, oh, I think maybe 15 or 20 minutes would have done it.
And how long were you down there?
Well, we got out about 6 p.m. Monday night.
And this happened before 8 a.m. Sunday morning.
The ship had already been hit with all those torpedoes and already turned over. And they drilled holes wherever they had to get to us. We were very fortunate. We had two seamen on there. They'd gone to quartermaster school in the States before. They had just joined the ship about 2 weeks before the war started. And they knew Morse code. Somehow they got to talking to some of these people. And they finally told him, don't talk to us anyway. We know where you are and we're coming as fast as we can. When they did get down to us, they drilled these holes. They said, get ready to come out. When you get ready to take you out of here, just stiffen out. Because they had both sides of the places where they'd had those holes drilled. They just passed us out of the ship. And there was a Liberty boat down there, and one of the guys, George DeLong, he said, I was sure hoping I could go to Mass tonight. And this guy says, man, this is not Sunday night, this is Monday night.
You guys didn't even know how long you'd been down there.
I didn't have a clue.
You were trapped inside a sunken ship, running out of air to breathe, water filling up this hold. You were trapped in there for 34 hours.
That's right.
But you're talking about it like it's no big deal.
Well, it was a big deal, all right, because I knew if we didn't get out of there, we're done. Oh, I was scared. We all talked very positively. They'd get to us some way. Lieutenant Commander Hobby was the ship's first lieutenant. He kept talking to us, and when we got down where we could talk to him verbally, we got our spirits up then, and we thought, now he's going to really get us out of here. And by golly, they did.
When did you find out for sure that your brother was one of the casualties that day?
No one ever did come and tell me. I just had to accept that as I know Daryl didn't get through it.
Have you ever stopped and wondered what Darryl would have done with his life if it hadn't ended on December 7th, 1941?
Darryl was one hell of a baseball player, good pitcher. He was on the Oklahoma team, and I'm sure he would have gone into pitching in the big leagues sooner or later.
And I've talked to a lot of guys who didn't lose siblings in the war, but lost friends. And a lot of them felt like the life they led, that they couldn't take anything for granted. They had to stay positive and move forward, because if their friends had lived, that's what they would have done. Did you ever feel anything along those lines, feeling like you had to live in a way that would have honored your brother's sacrifice?
I tried to. Probably didn't do a very good job. I used to think about him all the time.
Those words from Mr. Artley, recorded just 3 weeks before his passing, were the last ones I included in a presentation this week at Hillsdale College in Michigan, where Hometown Heroes airs on affiliate WRFH. As I looked around that room and a crowd ranging in age from preteen to nonagenarian, I spotted many wiping the tears away from their eyes, and I was reminded again of how powerful these stories can be when we just take the time to let them sink in. How grateful we should be for those who have paid the price for our freedom, and how motivated we should be to make sure that our lives assign a value to that freedom that is worthy of the price. As I remind you that the original interviews with each of the 10 Pearl Harbor survivors you heard from today are linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com, I'm hoping that this hour has helped you understand even more deeply what I mean when I conclude each installment of this program with those same four words. Freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.